Good evening, everybody. We're hearing pings, but we're just going to have to go with it. I'll say just a couple things, Kelly, about, I mean, it's talk about commitment. I mean, you and I made a commitment to spend this hour talking about making commitments. And so that's cool. it just occurs to me we did that like, I don't know, a month and a half ago maybe, that we decided on this topic and then we were going to do this. And so that,
hey,
I find that, what?
Charlie, your sound is coming in and out now. And let's just
it's
check. Curious.
I'm not.
Are you having
No, I hear Charlie. I hear both of you.
Okay,
Jim,
great.
Are you? What do you hear?
Yeah, I confirm everything's fine from this end.
Okay, great. Good. That's my reception. I'm good now.
Anyway, so we agreed to talk about this. And I remember, you know, even though now it becomes something different because we've both thought about it, but I think the idea was, when we were talking about the last program we did about shortcomings and foibles and quirks, oh, and by the way, any of you who were listening last time, Perry had requested that I type up that poem about it, and I haven't yet, but it's not because I'm not committed to. I plan to, and it'll appear on the website at some point soon. But we were talking about that, and I think we got into a side conversation about dealing with our own shortcomings and how do you really change something that's a really ingrained pattern. I mean, do you remember it like that?
Yeah, and then I think the other was both of us having people in our life where they seem to be 100% committed to making changes, once they understood
right.
what was needed, and having that capacity in a way that seemed kind of phenomenal. So
right.
I think that was the
right.
other, this sort of somehow they 100% commit, and it's almost like they expect 0% back. They've just committed to improving, doing what they can to improve a relationship.
Yeah, those are people we were both talking about, that once they hear, let's say, from one of us or someone else close to them, could you please do such and such, that might just sort of say, okay. And then they would pull out all the stops to do that.
Yeah.
And I just have always been dazzled by that, being somebody who does a lot and yet am afraid to say something like that because then I'm afraid I'll be wrong, that I just won't be able to follow through with that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I think that's where we got started, and so tell me what you've been thinking about.
Well, so one thing I've been thinking, let me put two ideas out just as a starter. One thing I've been thinking about is how deciding that you're 100% committed to something just radically changes what you see or what you're. I think it's, there's some phenomena in saying that you're going to do something and really being kind of pushed to 100% commitment that you will make it happen that really changes the game in some fundamental way. So I definitely wanted to talk some about that. And then another idea, just to put it out here at the beginning, is there's a great book called Switch, How to Change Things When Change is Hard by Chip Heath and Dan Heath, who are just fantastic writers. And they have a really great three-part framework about how to do these types of change. And so I wanted to maybe put that some ideas from their book out on the table. How about you? Where did you go with this when you were?
Well, I've gone in a lot of directions about it and have been, I think even in thinking about this, it's changed some things about how I think of commitment. Having commitment coming from a lot of different places in my life, obviously one is working on getting people in therapy committed to making change, committed to certain specific goals or targets, has been one whole body of information that you and I both share and a lot of people on the phone might share. Another thing is just much more personal, just various experiences, I kind of went back through and thought about what have I committed to in 100% way, and what exactly has that meant, and what in my life have I done that with, or who do I know that has done that, and what are the characteristics, and how does, and my experience is that that does transform things also, so I'm interested in what you have to say about that. I think the main point that I have come to think differently about this, just thinking about it, is the degree to which it's what a subtle and fluid phenomenon it is to do what I have thought of as committing. How that to commit to something, let's say to commit, I mean, there's so many things I've committed to and not been able to stick to. Playing the piano, swimming 5 times a week, a mindfulness practice that's really completely steady, being present with my family when I'm with my family, making more friends that are really like really reciprocal, deepening friendships, and a million other things. So there's been so many commitments that I feel like I've made time and time again and not been able to then stick with, that I've realized that, you know, the nature of it when you make a commitment right now, if I make a commitment right now, it has a sort of a halo effect that it holds me for a while in that commitment. Mm-hmm. But it will, if I haven't realized what an evanescent thing it is to make a commitment, and that that's just the nature of the thing, at least for me. How to embody that, and so how to embody that in a way that it will go where I want it to go, and it will last. So I think I've just realized, you know, you can commit by saying, "Well, I'm going to do this." You can even say, "I am damn well going to do this." You can forcefully say,
yourself,
you know,
by the scruff of the neck.
Yes. Exactly. And say, I'm going to do this like I've never done anything before. You know, and nothing's going to stop me from doing this, you know, and I'm determined because I've seen it, how hard it is. You know, that's just one little, that's just a phenomenon in the moment that 3 days from now I might not be centered on.
Mm-hmm.
When I make a certain decision that actually eclipses that commitment starting 3 days later. I mean, it's like, oh, my God, you know, it took me 15 years to remember to put the towels back on the towel rack between me and my wife's, I mean, when it seemed like such a simple thing to commit to. Wow. So
yeah.
I've just been impressed at what, you know, you really have to embody a commitment with your thoughts, your emotions, the reinforcers in your life, the structures in your life, the other people in your life. If it's a significant thing, you have to make such room for it. And even then, it requires repeated renewals. So I guess that's one of the places I've...
Yeah. Well, that makes me think about this value of doing 100% commitment, because of the way it brings into relief, or, you know, really surfaces all these things you're talking about, all this reticence, all this hesitation, all these real obstacles, that it's not, I think there's something about, or at least for me, when I'm thinking about, especially like the process at the beginning of a DBT therapy, where you might be asking somebody to consider, you know, after a pretty long conversation of pros and cons from their perspective of giving up, say, self-harm, or giving up remembering one client, where, you know, there's such a safety in having a noose in her trunk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the way that made life bearable, because she felt like she could get out when she needed it. And, you know, that so the act of making 100%, when you really ask for 100%, take it off the table for a year. I think what comes, at least for me, when I'm put in that position, okay, 100% I'm committing, then all those things you were just describing, like, okay, wait a second, it's going to take reorganizing this, and I'm going to have to do that different. It's like you see all the cascade of events that are actually going to be required, whereas if it's less than that, there's something about a workaround. There's some way in which I don't actually get organized to move. You know, it is going to have that sort of dissolving effect. So I think there's something about that 100%, at least for me, that's really helpful. Would you agree, or what do you think about that idea?
Well, I think I think it's helpful if you have a realization that the act of saying that, feeling that, thinking that is not necessarily enough. That it's like, you know, you have to really try to create something sturdy. I mean, for example, I can't remember if in this forum I've said anything about this, but I have brought it up in teaching situations, so it's possible some people listening would have heard this. But it's such an example for me that when I committed quite a few years ago to publish papers, and that I hadn't published enough yet to make the hurdle of associate professor at Cornell, that when I had that, I was unambivalent about the goal, as far as I knew. I mean, I was unambivalent. I knew I wanted to do that. And I kept not doing it. And I was even talking to a therapist, a psychoanalytic therapist at the time, about doing that. And I could not quite get myself to take all of these ideas and papers and notes and outlines and turn them into something until I went to a therapist who specialized in helping people with this. And then what he and I hammered out over 2 to 3 weeks is still a model for me of what it takes. Because he really said, you know, I had to, how long is this going to take? Well, I'm going to do, I need to do it for 6 months. You know, how am I going to do it? Where in my day? Well, what's that going to require? Well, everybody's going to have to know until 9:30 in the morning, there is no phone call. Mm-hmm. There is no other work. I am not accessible. And it's going to include vacation times. And it was wow, I had to cancel some things. So I had to create this space, and then he challenged my ideas about what I was writing. He thought, when he heard what I was trying to write, he thought they were much too big. The topics were going to be really hard, and they weren't just publishing papers. They were trying to change the world. So he really, in a way, he sort of addressed my thinking to get down to, okay, what do I really want, and get more specific. And then we had to set up plans for how I would stick to this, and when I wouldn't stick to it, how can I, you know, I was supposed to call him if I was going to deviate from the plan. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I did once call him, you know, 90 minutes into my writing, and because the plan included me not writing beyond 90 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that, ultimately, I think, was that it helped reduce anxiety. And he understood that before I did, that actually if I knew I had done my 90 minutes, the rest of the day, I wasn't torturing myself about writing things down. It would come the next day. And so once that structure, I was so impressed, even though I felt like I was being treated like a kindergartner to do this. But actually once that structure was there and a schedule was there and he was there and there was accountability, and I did call him and say, I would like to write a little more because I'm really on a roll. He said, I'm so glad you called. Absolutely do not write anything more. Just reinforced. You know, important things will come back to you tomorrow. And really, it is one of the most successful commitments I've ever made was to that. But it really required understanding that I really had to see all the sneaky and slippery ways I work. Once I make a commitment, I'm going to slip out of it. And somehow he had done with this with enough people to really, do enough of this that I actually succeeded in 6 months of writing 6 papers and submitting them. And it was incredible. So,
That makes me think of, I mean, that's what you just described so fits this book, Switch, Chip Heath and Dan Heath's model of how to change things when change is hard. Can I just share these? Let me tell you these ideas.
Oh, I want you to. Yeah, I hadn't heard of this one.
This is a fantastic book. So they use this metaphor of getting yourself to change being like an elephant with a rider and a path. So that those are the three parts of the framework.
And, an elephant with a rider?
An elephant.
R-I-D-E-R, yes?
R-I-D-E-R, yeah. So imagine a big elephant and a little tiny rider at the top, trying to direct that big elephant, and then the path, you know, really clear path. And what they in essence say is kind of willpower or the executive functions that get us to, and what they're doing is really summarizing all the research, but in a very easy-to-read way. They say what you have to do is direct the rider. So what you were just talking about, they talk about what looks like resistance is often a lack of clarity. So if you provide crystal clear direction, like this kind of, you know, breaking it down, when, where, what, you know, that stuff, so you direct the rider, and then you have to motivate the elephant. And they talk a lot about what looks like laziness is often exhaustion, because your willpower is almost like a, the research is showing it's almost like a muscle, that it wears out, self-control wears out. So if you exert self-control of, say, inhibiting an impulse, then on a completely unrelated task, you actually show a decrement for some period of time. And it takes energy, like a muscle does, to exert that kind of self-control. And so what the rider, the sort of self-control, can't get its way, it can't sort of drag you by the scruff of the neck to get you to do stuff. You actually have to engage that emotional side. And so to connect deeply with why making the change is important. And they have this fantastic story about they're trying to get, a company was trying to get, motivate the executives to actually go with a standard sizing of plastic gloves. And the person who was initiating this cost-saving measure, because I guess they had like 50 different types of gloves, colors, sizes, weirdnesses, and it was quite expensive to make all those. So the person who was trying to make this change couldn't get them to move until they brought one pair of gloves from each of the different types and stacked them on the conference table. So when the executives walked in and actually saw a mound of all the gloves, so they actually saw, like, this is the impact. So they talk about motivating the elephant, like really harnessing the emotions toward the change, like why is it important, what's the value behind it. And then the last part they talk about, which I think you were just saying too, is shape the path. That sometimes what looks like a problem person is actually a problem situation, that you actually need to structure the environment, create the contingencies that will support the change behavior. So I think that framework is so lovely. Like it, for me, it creates a visual, and it's also completely consistent with the research literature about self-control and getting yourself to change and the importance of structuring the environment. It's, but what do you think? What do you think about
that? Well, I like that a lot. I do think that the last thing you said about shaping the path and how to structure the environment so that it'll work, it requires having a pretty significant degree of understanding of how the given person works. How much are they structured by certain things? You know, there are people, I once had a woman who saw me in therapy a long, long time ago, and completely, I don't think there's any risk of this being identifiable, but she would come to sessions, and after a while, it seemed like she wasn't really using the sessions to make changes in her life the way I like to see, or the way I think of myself as working. And so I would now and then say, but why are you coming? Let's talk about what you're trying to do here, because, we get along very well and we're working on things, but I don't know what brings you here. And she said, you're in my schedule book. I said, really? That's what brings you here? Yeah. She said, I open up my schedule book each day, and there you are, you know, once a week. And I said, really? How long ahead am I in your schedule book? She said, a year. I said, so does that mean you're coming for a year no matter what? And she said, yes. I thought, wow. I mean, that's, I mean, now, so she was committed to a process.
Yeah.
Now, she wasn't necessarily committed to something that I think of therapy as committing to, but actually, it turned out that was very important to her. And there are people who are committed to processes. So, but I think my first point was that it's really different. I mean, what, like my swimming, for instance, when I have managed to swim really regularly, which is my main form of exercise since getting arthritis in my hip 20 years ago after running for a lot of years, I swim. But the years that I was in a swim club where I was there and I had responsibility to my lane mates, I mean, the three people in my lane at, what, 6 in the morning, 3 days a week, which was incredibly hard to do, but I was there because that is something about me. I mean, if I sign up and there's somebody there who's thinking I'm going to be there, and I'm part of the lane, and there was an esprit, I mean, I just did it. I just couldn't believe it. I actually almost was dissociating from myself, thinking, who is this person that is getting up at 5:15 every day, every other day, and swimming? I like, wow, what is getting me to do this? And I thought, oh, Elizabeth and Barbara, mainly the two of them, I mean, I'm doing it because of them. I think it's sort of, you know, so I hook on to accountability and a schedule. But somebody else might not hook on to that. Mm-hmm. They might hook on to something else. So I do think shaping the path means knowing with a given person what it is that's going to matter.
Yeah, it sounds like in social contingencies, I mean, those would be both be quite important, both of the things you just described, accountability and in the social way, and the, it sounded like, was it the emotional accountability? What were your two things?
Well, accountability and to them, and then the fact that it was in my schedule.
Yeah.
You know, and that it was difficult. I mean, that not all people work that way, but I've been a person all my life who, if there was something difficult I'm doing, for some reason it jacks up my intentionality or the likelihood of following through. It's as if there's something to prove. But other people, again, don't necessarily. So I really think when I started thinking about these things and thinking, well, all of the times I've worked with people in therapy and at the beginning have used the commitment strategies in DBT and, like you said, the reviewing the pros and cons and doing shaping or eliciting, you know, what's the prior commitment that's been made and how this can be hooked on to that and the several other strategies. All of those seem very helpful, but it seemed like they sometimes don't take into account, at least the way I've thought I've been good at doing this, but I realize, oh, no, I have to identify the path, as you put it, the path that the elephant's going to go on. Because those are all sort of done in the moment with the intention of getting the person to sign on. But I have to take more seriously. Actually, we have to anticipate the path, really.
Yeah, really.
Really,
that's
really
what happens for me with 100%. It's this anticipating of the path, really. And then I face the difficulty, and then that makes me go deeper into the emotion, really, like, why is this worth it? Why is that amount of effort worth it? That kind of devil's advocate strategy of really letting the person argue for the change rather than the status quo. I think there's that, to me, is another really powerful move that comes out of going for 100% commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing it made me think of when you were talking, this move toward one's values, the real pros about changing, like maybe a person doesn't really care about whether or not they're going to cut themselves. It's just they can't stand the fact that their kids are going to see the scars. you know, and that mm-hmm. is actually the deep value that's going to motivate a lot of change, or that they connect with the fact that they don't want they want to somehow model a way of regulating their emotion that's different,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But just, I think there's something about this connection to the values, the way of going for the emotion, or what Heath and Heath call the elephant, that's really important.
Why the elephant? They must explain.
Why do they call it that?
Yeah, why are they calling, why is in this metaphor an elephant used?
Their model actually maps pretty nicely right on to reasonable mind, rational mind, and integration. Where they end up going is wise mind, in essence. They talk about the integration of these two, and how do you create that integration?
Mm-hmm.
I think the elephant is really meant to represent that sort of way in which we are see, at least for me, around some things. It's like the rider feels very small in the heat of a moment under stress. You know what comes up? Complete emotion mind, and that mm-hmm. sort of, you know, you lose your temper or you whatever. That I think that's why they have that sort of it's very hard to control the, you know, your organism. It's very hard to manage your emotions,
mm-hmm.
and when the stakes are really high, the stress is really high.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you have to. I mean, the you're saying the person we're identifying with, the rider, and the elephant is how difficult it is to direct yourself to change, to get yourself on the path. You have to motivate the elephant.
Yes.
To go that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how helpful it is to really to not exert, like, drag yourself towards something, but to actually motivate, to connect with what's the reason for the change. It made me look up one of my favorite researchers, is Todd Kashdan, Kashdan.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a ton of different interesting stuff, but one of the things he's done is on personal strivings, the ways that we decide to organize our time and money and sort of life energies. And there's some really interesting research coming out of his and others' work about if you have strivings that are toward something, as opposed to strivings that are away, like strivings that are about minimizing pain or moving away from, you know, preventing mistakes, stuff like that. So they're
mm-hmm.
more avoidance-oriented. The avoidance-oriented ones are actually associated with decreased sense of self-competence and self-esteem and lower life satisfaction, whereas the ones that are moving toward, personal strivings that are moving toward something, are more associated with better well-being in that. So I think there's something, too, about what you're striving for. Like, what's the actual goal? What are you committing to? Is it a toward or is it an away sort of move? Does that make sense, or what do you think about that?
Well, and also it clearly depends on to what degree it is. When you were just saying this, toward, I was just thinking, how many times I've been able to convince people in therapy or at least get them to own a certain direction or a certain goal
mm-hmm.
that actually I learned later was more my goal than theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And how alert you have to be, and how what a context of freedom you have to offer so that people are striving towards something. And it's something that actually they buy. I think this is what the devil's advocate strategy helps with, done time and time again. And even then, I guess the thing that I keep is how much these things do change once you've made a commitment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like take people who have done amazing things. Like take, you know, the people who created Google or Starbucks or Hewlett and Packard. And those would be companies. I mean, and then there's a lot of personal examples. And
Gandhi.
You find, pardon?
Gandhi, pardon? And the whole movement
Gandhi,
of nonviolence.
Right.
Yeah.
Whole movements, and you find that that actually See, what you learn by retrospectively looking at people who've accomplished things, and whether it's people in treatment who've been able to stop cutting and to pursue other things in their life, or companies that end up doing some, you know, highly successful thing, is that when you really look closely prospectively of what people are doing, they're often not committing to those things. Those things are the outcome of committing to other things. Mm-hmm. For instance, you take like Hewlett and Packard and many other companies. They actually, Hewlett and Packard did not envision creating an electronics company or any of the things that they made specifically. Hewlett and Packard committed, they were two guys that committed to working on stuff together because they thought it was incredible. And they liked it, and they liked each other, and they would make things, and then other things, and then other things that eventually led to other things. So they kind of committed to a process that had interpersonal reinforcers, and I think emotional reinforcers. And so I sometimes think, let's say if somebody wants to do exercise, play music, or change their life in other ways, that you really have to titrate down to something that they feel really passionate about doing, that they really care about doing. A lot of the time, you know, a sort of a nearer goal rather than the long-term goal. So if you were just trying to get the elephant to go down a certain path, it might be, you know, you trying to get the elephant to go that first 100 steps, not get to Mecca, you know, with you on it. So I think there's also a thing about how far out are you looking for what you're committed to, because I think it can become dysfunctional to commit yourself to something way out there. Because then you feel constrained, and it can actually even end up feeling like a failure, whereas in fact it makes more sense as a person to commit to something right here and now that just takes you a little ways.
It makes me think Colleen Ehrenstrom taught a fantastic course for our group on cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, and she and another colleague, Alicia Bros, taught one on CBT for bipolar disorder, and both of them, when they asked for a change, they had a very standard question they would always ask, which is, how committed are you to doing this? Whatever it was, and then the person would give a percentage. And then they would go through a series of things that what would it take to get it up to 100%? And they didn't, there was just kind of a way they worked, which is they never did anything that the person wasn't 100% certain they would actually do. And so it might be troubleshooting, or it might be making it smaller, it might be connecting more deeply with the values, but they did all those steps, you know, right in the moment, and they always left about, you know, a good 10 minutes in the session to do that type of very detailed work about how will you get it to go, is this correct, you know, is it the right move, and how will it work. I thought that was, I mean, that's one thing I adopted after working with those guys in their class, and it's been really helpful. It's so mundane, like when you were saying earlier, you know, it's like you're a, you know, grade schooler, but I think there's something about that level of concreteness that's so helpful.
Well, I hesitate to ask because it might put you on the spot, but you can always just say, I'm sorry, it puts me on the spot. But I'm curious if you identified something that you would be shareable, that you would like to change and that you are somewhat committed to. What would be an example of this? And then,
well, actually,
I
have a fantastic one I'm working on that I did actually commit to. We have an exercise class on Mondays. Everybody commits to something, and so mine has been in the evenings to do something other than a glass of wine to reduce my stress. And I'm going for behavioral variability. Really, anything would count. And so that's our starting place. That's what I'd be willing to.
Wait, that's what you want to commit to doing.
I want to reduce my stress in a way different than having a glass of wine in the evening.
Mm-hmm. And so, but so the positive thing you'd be committing to, you called behavioral variability. What do you mean? Do different things each time?
Yeah, just it's. I guess what I'm trying to do is create that freedom you were talking about earlier. Is it really doesn't matter what other thing happens.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be something. So, you know, the first move I had was actually brainstorming a bunch of different things that might actually help.
Mm-hmm.
And then trying them and seeing what was the actual impact. You know, were they helpful? How hard were they to do? And just it was just to get new behavior happening in that context.
Mm.
And see what would come.
Mm-hmm. So where along the spectrum, if I asked you, how committed are you to use other behaviors rather than having a glass of wine on Monday night to reduce stress? How committed are you?
I would say 85% during the week,
mm-hmm.
and maybe 50% during the weekend.
Okay. I understand this. all right. So then, what would it take to get it up to 100% during the week? I mean, what's that 15%?
Part is remembering. It's having reminders and
mm-hmm.
having the new behaviors, like, super available, like really structuring my environment. So
mm-hmm.
I can, being 100%, yeah, I would be 100% certain. And this is what I did my first week, is I set out, I have a certain exercise stretching mat, and I have a nice thing you warm up in the microwave, and I have a particular types of music. And I actually set, at the beginning of the week when I made the commitment, I set them all out so I could actually find them. And I downloaded a certain, I really love a certain types of books, so I downloaded a couple of samples because they were free on my Kindle. So I had my mm-hmm. I had my array of new behaviors available and easy, organized.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't. You know what? I didn't make any public commitment to anybody who would actually help me in my environment. Like, I didn't tell Tom or Claire.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been a smart move.
You mean because they actually care, or they would just want to help
they
you
would
if
be
you
helpful.
Said you care?
Yep, they would help me if I said I care, and I don't quite have the. I feel like I could duck out of my accountability with my group, my exercise group, because it's a large group, and that maybe I wouldn't have to fess up.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's a really good point. I once was, when I was practicing, the most regular period of practicing mindfulness in my life was when I was with a very small sangha, and I would, you know, it really felt like energizing and accountable.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone to other ones where it's big and you can come and go and you might not be noticed that much if you're not there. It really doesn't do
yeah.
the same thing. I mean, for me,
that's
interpersonal accountability is huge.
Me too.
But that's interesting, that to get that 85% up, because it immediately would raise a lot of questions. And this is where I say it's actually, to get someone to commit is so, it's a bigger deal than what it is. What exactly are you committing
yeah.
to? That's a strange thing to commit to. You know, because you're committing to anything other than a glass of wine. So actually, maybe the thing that would help you most is if there's no wine available. There's no wine in Seattle.
That would
be
extremely likely to get me to 100% because I would never make a trip out on a stressful night. That's exactly
oh, see?
Right.
So,
structuring
so,
the
yeah.
environment. Mm-hmm.
So you'd have to, yeah, but and then that would be a big decision that would affect other things, could affect other people, could, I mean, so, but if you really wanted to get to 100% and it was really hard, but you might not need that to get there.
No,
if you
I
really.
I think that's fantastic because I think a lot of, at least for a lot of my clients, it really does take that. Like you have, there's 100% commitment to remove the means, and that's the only thing that's going to make it 100% certain the person won't self-harm.
Mm-hmm.
If it's there in the moment of weakness, no matter what, you know, the earlier really heartfelt, sincere
mm-hmm.
you know, but the willpower muscle has been worn down, and you're at the edge, and you relapse. You drink or you cut or, you know, whatever the extreme is. I think just removing the means, structuring the path is so important.
Yeah, I think it is. I think what's important about it is that it really is an example of thinking through if it is going to be difficult. And if you really want that, you know, and but then, of course, you might just get there and not do something else that helps reduce stress. You might just sit there and think, God, I wish I had a drink of wine, and spend some time doing that, which will not help. But it would be more likely to prompt you to do something else. You might have to, you know, you might be pissed off, or you might think, oh, this is ridiculous. I mean, that's what I see. I make commitments to things like that sort of thing. And then I think, why do I care this much? I mean, I care about it a lot when I do it. And then, you know, 2 weeks later something comes up, I think, oh, come on. What's the big deal?
You need a devil's advocate. You need a really good devil's advocate.
I need a devil's advocate in the face all the time. I mean, for things that are difficult. I mean, but I tell you, I don't know who doesn't, you know. I had a person that I worked with not that long ago who wanted to reduce stress in her life. And we figured out the way that really she agreed in the meeting, this would do it. I mean, if she stopped her work day at 4 instead of 5, and it gave her, and she has a commute, and it gave her an extra block of time before she launched into her evening plans, which are taking care of children and stuff, I mean, she was going to have a stress-relieving period of time. We agreed on it. And she did it, I mean, rapidly. I was really, when she came back 2 weeks later, I was so impressed with what she had done. And in fact, it totally made the difference. And I thought, we nailed it. This is it. Wow, how good. You know. And part of it was because we really worked on it in the way that you say that these people were recommending. You know, the Ernstrom. Yeah. You know, that really... She just said she's going to do it, and she did it, and it worked. All right, well, then I saw her 2 weeks later, and it was like, well, I'm doing it most of the time.
Uh-huh.
Then about a month later, it's like I've kind of let that part go because things were really going better.
Yeah.
And I need the work. So it's like, uh-oh, here we are again. And in fact... she started to be more stressed out. So, and she's a very determined, I mean, person, you know. So I think that's the common course for people.
I do. I agree.
And how do you get that to keep going? I mean, the maintained accountability, because life changes. 2 weeks later, life doesn't look the same as it looked 2 weeks ago. Things don't look like they matter quite as much, especially if you feel you've gotten better. And, you know, unless it's something like, let's say you've had a heart attack or some other disaster in your life that's really, you don't want it to happen ever again, you really have to line up. Even with that, you have to line up the whole scenario.
Yeah.
I mean, you really have to. And people are different about what will make them fight for it.
Well,
and nothing's forever. Commitment's never forever.
No, I think that's right. You know, what you just made me think of is the difference between, say, an abstinence goal or a moderation. You know, this kind of 100% commitment versus some other middle path. And I think that's also really an important consideration about what's the correct path. There's Miller and Rolnick, Rolnick, have a great book on... moderate drinking for problem drinkers, that where they go through, like, what are the contingent, like, when would you go one direction towards an abstinence goal, when would you tolerate a kind of more moderation goal? And that makes me think of your person. It's like, when is it okay to have that kind of more moderate goal where you're shooting for, you know, 80%, or you're shooting for, you know, 4 nights a week of less,
you know,
stress.
And there, I think the synchrony between the therapist and the patient about this matters a lot, or dissynchrony, because let's say that you are 100% type, or at least you are with respect to your patient, with respect to this particular behavior. So your patient, like mine, comes in and says, well, I'm doing it most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking, unless you're like on this, like, you know, like intense and 100%-ish, you're saying, well, that's still pretty good. And then you have a conversation with, well, maybe it'd be a good idea to get yourself back to the 100%. I mean, really be doing it. But a whole different approach is the person does that and you say, oh, my God, you're slipping.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, what can we do to get you back there? Because you kind of, but then if you're not in sync with the person you're seeing and you talk like that, they think,
yeah.
Oh, Jesus, I have a Gestapo therapist here. Like, they're going to, wow, oh, my God. And
yeah.
You've really invalidated them because they feel like they're doing pretty good. So it's a tricky thing. It's hard enough to interact with yourself
mm-hmm.
about something you've committed to and then you've slipped a little bit.
Right.
It's hard enough to commit to interact with yourself and make sure all of the various parts of yourself are still on board. Or maybe
yes.
there's this other little part that isn't fully on board yet, but it doesn't look that bad to you.
Yeah,
To do it with someone else is another whole thing. I mean, to have another person
yeah.
in the room you're doing this with.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it just made me think, too, then there's that abstinence violation effect. So if you
mm-hmm.
slip, and then you slip a little, then you kind of toss in the towel and you just say, you know, so much for that, and you
right.
give up. Yeah.
Right.
And so I think that social contingency, when there's some really interesting research on these strivings when a person is perfectionistic and when they there's a concern about how others view them around commitments, around accomplishments,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and that can be really problematic so that you could really, I think your point is an excellent one, you could really push somebody into a completely untenable position if you were too strong, and that was really an issue for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if they go with you, but actually, that's what I was saying, that you know, I think that each of us is in a certain way of thinking made up of different parts. And we don't usually talk about it that way, but it's kind of like you've got to get all the parts to agree to do certain things. But it's very hard because just when you think that you've got yourself all together and you've agreed to do this or you've got your patient to agree to give up drinking,
mm-hmm.
And to do something else instead to accomplish some of the same goals that, you know, that then there's a little part that almost always comes up. And then at that point is capable of kind of interrupting the whole rest of it. So I think
yeah.
it's a really difficult thing. I mean, I like best the kind of commitments that are like, here's what I'm going to do for the next 3 minutes. You know, even those are hard, you know, because you never even know. I mean, if you have a household with teenagers like I do, and you say that at home, you really don't know. I mean, or you can really decide, and it can be challenging, but there's always something that could dismantle your
mm-hmm.
plan and how to kind of, for me, again, the thing of having accountability, and I've worked with this a lot with my patients, if there's not somebody that they're accountable to, and not just me sometimes, because they might see me in the next week,
mm-hmm.
but how do you
mm-hmm.
get accountability so that your commitment is held in the accountability, or your commitment
yeah.
is held in the schedule, whatever
yeah.
it is.
Yeah. You know, in acceptance and commitment therapy, the way that this is approached is you're 100% committed toward your values, toward the direction, not the specific goal. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, you may have to adjust course. You plan to do X, but because you live with teenagers, it doesn't happen. But are
mm-hmm.
you heading the direction? You know, like if you picked north, you can always go north. You know, and you may slip, and then you're heading north, and then you, you know, trip up, and then you're heading north, or you do a little detour, and then you're heading north. And I think
mm-hmm.
that quality of something that's longer range, but the direction, not the immediate goal, is
mm-hmm.
another really important skill set for us as therapists that I think, mm-hmm. may bypass some of the other trouble spots that we've been talking about, the ways that that sort of perfectionism might fire, the way that abstinence effect violations or the violation effects may kick in, stuff like that.
Well, Kelly, you had mentioned to me something that you called, that you read somewhere, called the 80-20 rule. Is that part of what you're talking about now? Because I
no, that's was that's interested. Different. Yeah, the so Pareto's principle. It's coming out of I think he was originally an economics person. I'm not positive mm-hmm. about what his science was, but mm-hmm. it turns out that this principle holds out over across a lot of different stuff. But the idea is that the results in any situation are determined by some small number of causes. So, like 80% of the outcome you get is actually from 20% of your inputs or...
Hey,
you know,
Kelly,
yeah.
I'm going to have to interrupt it. Would you carry this for a minute? Because I keep getting a call from and I have to take it. I'll be right back.
Okay. Sure,
sorry about
sure.
that.
Okay. So what I was going to say is 80-20% is about... military. Of course, the dog's barking.
Yeah, well, that's why we have everyone on mute, but you guys... Don't worry about it.
Well, so, but this idea is that you can be strategic about what you put energy toward. So mm-hmm. this 80% of outcome coming from 20% of the effort, 80% of your revenue coming from 20% of your customers. And the idea here is that you're strategic about what you put in effort toward. And I think that was, you know, we'll see what Charlie thinks when he comes back. But for me, I really started to think, okay, so given that, where is it most important to put my effort? Like, what is the handful of activities that would produce the most impact? And at both, you know, personally, but I was thinking primarily clinically. And I just keep coming back to validation. Like, to me, there's something about validation that is the most important thing to all other tasks. Like, if I'm only going to do one thing, right. it would be to...
Kelly, I'm back on, by the way.
Okay, great. Just but to put my energy there, because so many things are potentiated by accurate validation of what's valid. And so that was where I was kind of going. So, and I think the other thing that I was just saying, Charlie, you know, given that you have to be strategic about what do you put energy toward, mm-hmm. The Pareto principle would say, you know, 20% of what you do produces 80% of the effort, and so validation is one. But the other, for me, has been a focus on taking care of the present moment, like really doing my best to come back to a very simple practice over and over of like. Experiencing my body breathing, like the actual shape of my body mm-hmm. in space,
mm-hmm.
and following my breathing for a little bit, and then just trying to take care of the present moment as best I can. Not future, not past, but like this very moment, what is needed, and that kind of wise mind integration. So, I, you know, again, of all the different things I might really try to practice, that one to me has become... over the last year and a half, the fundamental one I'm practicing.
You know, me too. It's completely. That is absolutely become, and to do that regularly, or to, you know, but it's a return to that again and again and again. And that's exactly what I just spent the weekend with. Oh, by the way, what just happened was exactly what I said. I am like totally committed. Kelly, I am, you know, now I realize I'm not totally committed to this call because, you know, I got 3 calls in a row on my cell phone from my wife, and I thought, oh, no. You know, and I know one of my sons is at a party. He's for the first time ever. He's 13, and he's at a dance party. I thought, I'm going to have to take this. So, you know, it shows you, like, this is not 100%. How hard that is that you just don't even know. At the time that you say, there's nothing is going to interrupt me from this call. So I'm sorry I left you anyway.
But it's a perfect example. And what you do, you came right back to the direction. And with a lot of presence of mind to step right back in. I think that this, to me, that's a beautiful example of a committed action. is that you can't be a Nazi with yourself either. You know, that there really are competing priorities. And then you have to adjust, and then you come back, and you adjust like a bobo doll,
you can't,
Charlie.
In planning, like the path for the elephant, you cannot know for sure what is going to happen on the elephant's path. You cannot know ahead. When you get a patient of yours to commit to not cut herself or to not drink or to build in a stress-relieving event in their life on a regular basis, they may absolutely mean it in the time they're accountable to you, and you can't anticipate. So there is a way in which it can become like a Nazi kind of thing to do, this 100% commitment. And so you really have to do it and realize, you know, like I told you earlier, with my 17-year-old at an ultimate frisbee tournament in northern Vermont for the whole weekend starting Friday. And then I came back late today, and they have it's so interesting we're talking about this, because they have a coach, their head coach. His job in life is that he is a motivational consultant for people who do sales in their companies all over the place. And he's a really good speaker, and he's really good at motivating the kids. And he was thinking about what visualizations to have them do before their ultimate frisbee games. You know, and he was talking about, you know, should we have them visualize themselves winning? No, you can't do that. I mean, there are so many things that can interfere with winning. So shall we have them, you know, visualize doing a certain type of play on a certain point in a certain moment, you know, so that they can really get into that, and that's something they have some control over. But actually what he had them visualize this morning, because of things that had come up, but he had them really do it. And then he held them accountable during their three games today, which was he had them visualize, if you make a mistake, visualize forgiving yourself immediately. Let it go and move on, you know, out of that moment to the next point or the next whatever it is. And then he had them do one other visualization, which is visualize if you're in a close game and one of your fellow players makes a mistake, visualize a reaction to them that's really positive. And they did that, and then during the day they did that more than I had ever seen. I've watched this team grow together, and it was really interesting that just committing to that one thing. So it really went along with just, I think that the power of being able to do a pretty major commitment to one thing, to small things that are on the path, is probably more helpful in most cases than visualizing the end state or the end of the path where you're going, because there are so many variables that can take you off that you really want to visualize the process of guiding the elephant and the process of handling, you know, the first steps on the path. And then you need to do it again, because reality changes every day anyway.
I agree with that. Well, Charlie, wow, that time went fast, didn't it, today?
Oh, my God, it's 9. Oh, yes. Okay, so... it really does go fast, you know. You think, what are we going to talk about? And then it's gone. So that's it. So we've done
Kelly,
it.
Kelly, I don't know if you can appreciate what kind of journey you took us on. There was one or two people who dropped off the call and came immediately back on. So when we, and it's not you, Charlie. But the point
other than me.
But the point is that people were so committed to this call that I think that your message started out to be so powerful and just carried through for the whole time. I'm curious to hear people's reactions, and I hope they'll send them to us.
Please do.
Oh, yeah, feedback is so helpful.
We really, Kelly and I have done this 3 times now, and we really would love to have feedback. And we have gotten some feedback. And by the way, those of you who have written something, we're absolutely noticing it and thinking about it. One person recently wrote about maybe we should take calls sometimes. And we're absolutely open to thinking about that. So we can
certainly do that. We can figure out a way that not everybody has an open line at the same time, so that we can monitor back background noise. But
yeah.
I was also just thinking about the idea of motivation and your son's coach and what a wonderful gift that is to help people figure out even what that even means, to be motivated. But I just found all of tonight just so powerful. So, again, I thank you. I'm not clear when our next date is. Are you both clear on that?
You know, but there was, I don't have my calendar in front of me, but we did have a next date, and then I said I can't make it.
Right, that was June 10th.
That's right, June 10th. And then we had something in July, and I think it might have been later July, Perry, if you have something down that I think was going to therefore be the next one. Is that right? Do you have something in front of you?
I really don't, but if you want to send me the what you think it is, that would be great. I mean, I'm sorry that we're going to have such a big gap, so if there's anything else that frees up both of you, do let us know.
Okay. Great.
Okay, we'll email each
we'll
other and you.
We'll get together about that,
Okay,
see
thank
possible.
You so much. This was just unbelievable. Also, the two of you always give wonderful references to things. If you could send us the references, we'll post them, because I know I was trying to write them down but didn't get all of them.
Oh, that's
okay,
a good
great.
Idea.
Okay, great, yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, send
thank
the book
you to both
and
of you.
Cash them. Yeah, okay, great.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye, all.
All right, guys. Bye, Perry. Bye, Kelly.
Bye-bye. Take care.
See ya.
Bye-bye.